Managing Violence Podcast, Season 5, Episode 7, with Aaron Morden. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. It's going to be quite an interesting one this week. But before we get into that, I've got a couple of quick announcements. Firstly, I need to welcome the two newest members of the Tribal Elders. That is CP. I don't know CP's full name, but CP, thank you very much for your contribution. And Ray Orty. Ray, thanks very much for joining in the fun and getting all the bonus content. Greatly appreciated. All those who contribute to the Managing Violence Podcast on Patreon. And the other little announcement is about a podcast that I'd like you to check out. One of our long-term listeners and supporters, Mr. Dag Helly from Norway, has been chatting to me quite a bit, and he was inspired by the podcast and wanted to start his own in the Norwegian language. So I have no competition in speaking Norwegian. Dag has started his own podcast called Fighter Mindset. You can check that out. He does episodes both in his native Norwegian and in English. So he just had Richard Dimitri on, so that's a good chat. But make sure you check out Dag's podcast because he's doing really good stuff, and hopefully he's making the people of Norway safer. All right, without further ado, I'm jumping into this week's episode. It is with returning guest Aaron Morden. Aaron, last time he was on, we talked about executive protection, particularly from the perspective of AS Solution, which is the company that Aaron works for. He's a training manager for them and an operative for them in the executive protection space. But today, we are talking to Aaron from the perspective of ZERT. Now, ZERT is the Zombie Eradication Response Team, which was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek training operation that Aaron set up a little over 10 years ago now, to prepare people for managing disasters and basically being more prepared. Pre-Doomsday Prepper, Aaron was doing some pretty cool stuff when it comes to preparing people for worst-case scenarios. Now, given everything that's happening in the world right now, I thought it was very, very topical to get Aaron on to talk a little bit about how to manage your safety if you're caught up in civil unrest. Now, obviously, in some parts of the world at the moment, we've got some civil unrest happening. We've got protests. We've got some riots happening. We've got, in some cases, there's looting happening. But also, this is equally applicable to if you're caught up in the aftermath of a terrorist event, or if you're caught up in the aftermath of a football riot, or anything else where people are behaving irrationally and violently, and you need to get to safety. So that's the topic of the conversation today. It's not just about what's happening right now. It's about any time that your safety might be compromised and you need to get to safety, either get home or bug out. So Aaron Morden from ZERT XP001 is our guest for this week, and let's get into the interview. Aaron Morden from ZERT. Aaron is a second appearance on the podcast. Previously, we spoke about executive protection, close personal protection, through Aaron's other role with AS Solution, which is one of the leading close personal protection firms in the United States. And but today we're talking about ZERT. So, Aaron, firstly, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Secondly, what is ZERT? For those that haven't heard the first episode where we talked about it very briefly, or those who haven't Googled it, what is ZERT?
ZERT stands for Zombie Eradication Response Team. So about 10 years ago, we just basically started a membership organization where we use zombie as the metaphor. So we can go out and train. We can talk about shooting zombies in the face and be politically correct about it. The key thing is that the zombie is a metaphor for the individual, meaning that what is your zombie? Is it a natural disaster? Is it a deadly force encounter? Is it civil unrest? It can span on various different things and allows our members to use that zombie to train accordingly for personal protection and preparedness.
Yeah, and I think that's so cool. I mean, I must have come across ZERT right at the very beginning because I've known about it for forever. And at the time, I thought it was like, there's a whole bunch of zombie stuff going on at the time. Like, there was a, I'm not sure whether it was there was a movie or something, but something.
The Walking Dead, probably.
Maybe, yeah, it might have been The Walking Dead, but something had prompted all this zombie influence. Because I remember going to a gun shop and had these like bleeding zombie targets you could buy. And then like literally a couple of weeks later, I came across this zombie eradication response team. I was like, man, the zombie thing's going crazy. It was interesting. It got really popular here because we've got very strict regulations on what you can shoot at, right? So you can't shoot at human-shaped targets. If you're a civilian, it has to be like a bullseye. And they got around it by saying they're not humans, they're zombies, right?
Hey, that's the way to do it, right?
it was a brief loophole before it got closed up. But yeah, it was quite interesting. As long as they looked undead, you're allowed to shoot them. But anyway, it's a topic for another day. So what sort of training do you guys provide? I mean, it's not all lethal force. It's not all firearms. That's obviously fun stuff, but what sort of other stuff do you do?
It spans. We do everything from land nav, like basic Boy Scout stuff, but just for adults, land nav, basic survival to, medical, to vehicle tactics, to shooting tactics, CQB, We have a thing called the Keystone Challenge that's ran by one of our members in Pennsylvania. It was a 3-day full-blown survival event. So you set up your camp, you put security measures in place, and you learn and do prac app down to capturing your own food, may it be a chicken or a rabbit, and we teach you how to skin it and cook it and live it and improvise fishing, down to situational awareness and surveillance. And I have what we talked about before, the executive protection dad. So it just encompasses everything that the average Joe would need to protect his family or survive. And when you look at special operations units versus the other, the only difference is one is their mindset, their capabilities, but two is training. That's what separates us, the higher level training. And in the United States, since the global war on terror, there's a bunch of guys coming back, starting up their own schools. So what I did was handpicked a bunch of subject matter expert instructors to come in and teach programs. It's not about me. It's about the instructors. It's about the member. And yeah, that's pretty much it in a handbag. We probably ran over 220 training programs in the 9 years that we've been in business. I'm proud to say that we had what's an event called Outbreak Omega, which is the big zombie shoot that we took from Freedom Group, which is the largest firearms manufacturer. It's Remington, DPMS, Bushmaster. They had this event. We bought it. We ran with it. And at that time in 2013, I had 1,100 attendees for this event, 642 shooters on 44 ranges.
Wow.
And I had my biggest class. I had 140 students on 10 ranges with 10 SF instructors round robin. So it was just this a massive event where everyone came and camped out. And each of them had their own tribe. Like, one guy's were the gentleman zombie killer. So these guys were in suits with black ties and all their gear, and then their campsite, they had a bar, and after the shoot, they're making martinis, right? And then we had another group that were all like samurai swords and guns and all this stuff, and their campground had stakes with like zombie heads on it and tiki torches, and it was just a fun shoot. Guys came to train, but also too, those 44 ranges, they were all ranges with still targets and vehicles. And so you just go to a stage, shoot whatever gun on still, have fun, move to the next. The biggest controversy on that one was one of the local SWAT teams, the chief of police, was a member. He's like, hey, we just got this new MRAP for our SWAT team. We don't know how to use it. I'm like, well, I'll do a trade. You bring it out to the event so people can climb in it. We can shoot skeet out of it. And I'll give your officers a day of training. And it became very controversial because if you Google SWAT team and ZERT, there was a big write-up about the community using their taxpayers' dollars to get trained by zombie guys. And the chief of police came back and had a really, you know, educated answer on what ZERT was, the type of training that they got for, you know, the mount. So that's one event that we were holding every year. And then one of my probably prouder moments is we were the first private company to run training on a national park with guns, meaning any national park, guns are not allowed. So I rented out the USS Battleship Texas, which is the last of the juggernaut battleships that's down there in Texas. And I had five Navy SEALs and one Marine SOTG instructor. And we kind of had a VBSS, Vessel Board Search and Seizure, team event on the battleship. And the cool thing about it is that I donated proceeds. I donated $14,000 back to the ship for letting us use it. And they used that to pave the basin where it's at now. It's still sinking. It's sad. But it was just kind of shows the magnitude of, you know, a lot of the training events that we did, from basic firearms to big family friendly events.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, we're talking before we started recording about the shift in mentality towards things like, you know, disaster preparation it's sort of shifted in the public consciousness. I mean, Doomsday Preppers, in the TV show, kind of made the community out to be a bit of a joke, right?
And that's media for you, right? The TV shows can steer you one way or another, man.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, there were people like, I watched it because I knew in amongst some of the weirdos they were showing, like there were some nuggets of gold, right? There's some actually good stuff, right?
If you look at television. It,
yeah, but they made it in a way that the general public could have a chuckle at, and it would actually get ratings rather than having to watch it on YouTube. Right? And then you guys had the Nat Geo special as well. How did that come about?
Well, actually, it was Jack Osborne, Ozzy's and Sharon's son. He's a friend, and he's actually a member. Right. And when I first started, he showed up to actually the second class we ever ran. And I had my buddy Tyler Gray, who's a former Delta Force operator, and I had one Navy SEAL and another Army Special Forces guy. The guy, Tyler Gray, now is a writer, producer, and actor on CBS's SEAL team. So he's Trent in the show. So just so that's how that came. Yep. When Jack came to the class and seen how organized and motivated and how this motley crew of individuals, we had a class of 27 students for the CQB course. They were all wearing their black flight suits with their multicam gear. They had all their zert patches. He's like, wow, what is this? And then one member is a nuclear scientist at the Nevada test site. And another member is a legit brain surgeon. Then you have a kid who packages groceries at the local grocery store. Then you have a car mechanic. So it's just this motley crew of people that came together and were motivated to train. So when Jack seen that, he goes, man, there's a story behind this. We got to do something. So it took probably a year after that, we got the show rolling. It was very interesting because we were supposed to be slotted for an entire season, but it took us literally over a month to film that 45-minute episode. We had hiccups, like the first family, the kid fell and broke his collarbone, so they couldn't make it on the show. Then we had to shift another family. So it was just and it was during the summertime, so it's 120 degrees, so people out here in the desert were filming. It just didn't pan out well, right? But the show ended up turning out really good, and I think that we were portrayed in a positive light, not a crazy, you know, doomsday prepper type. There's a few lines that they kind of blurred in that, you know, like, I'm just an all-around badass. Like, I said that, but I started laughing after. I'm like, really, me? You know, but they cut that part out, so it just looks like I'm like, trying to boast myself. I'm like, come on, guys. But and they actually just reached back out due to the current state of affairs, hopefully we can actually get a full season. And reason why we didn't get the full season is because the Sandy Hook shooting happened, and most cable television pulled anything gun or tactics related. But at least we got the one show aired.
Yeah, it's a very cool show. I watched it again just recently and quite enjoyed it. It's got those little pieces of what would you say, a little bit of media exaggeration in there to make it entertaining. But look, you want people to watch it, so why not? As I started to say, we're talking before we started recording about people's mentality shifting. And excuse me, I think like 10 years ago, if you're preparing for the apocalypse, it was like, you're a little bit crazy. And now I think the last couple of months, especially the last couple of months, people started to go, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah, we can actually be completely unsettled by something that was well outside our control. Like businesses can close down. Supply chains can be disrupted. I need to actually be able to look after myself. I need, you know, people are looking at this going, how do I grow food? How do I hunt? And as people's income is disrupted and the economy is disrupted, then we see an increase in crime and victimization of people that aren't prepared. And the whole time this was happening, I think I reached out to you back in February or something. As I started to see this coming, I was like, man, we got to do a show about Zert because if ever there was...
I apologize, it took so long.
Hey, man, I understand you've been busy. That's why I wanted to get in, because I knew you guys were going to be busy. How have you seen that mentality shift amongst people that are reaching out to you?
So the biggest way that I can, the best way I can put it is our old mantra that, in my opinion, a zombie is an individual that will kill you or harm you for food, water, and shelter, which are the key things. Then you got security, which is the fourth part. But the mentality shift is a lot of what I want to call the millennials or the political tree huggers, you know, people that were nonviolent, that, you know, they're this, and we don't need this. A bunch of my buddies own gun stores nationally, like tons of them. And they said the amount of new gun people in the panic, their mentality is this. And this is what I really want to dive into is when we talk about mentality, they go, oh, if I have a gun, I'm safe. If I have food, I won't starve, right? So they have that knee-jerk reaction of a false sense of security. You know, they're going to go out and buy a gun and probably shoot themselves, you know, in the house trying to figure it out, right? Or in a deadly force encounter or trying to use it in a riot. So that's where it's just like, when we talk about that mindset shift here, I think it's opened everyone's eyes to the reality, how fast things can go bad. And most importantly, that the government and a lot of time law enforcement is not going to be there to help you because they're stretched so thin and they got to prioritize their calls, their emergencies. So and it's funny to see people's panic and reactions on what they're buying, right? You know, so that whole toilet paper thing, that was true, man.
You guys get the toilet paper? We got absolutely smashed with toilet paper. I don't know why.
Yeah, I took a training class in Utah 2 weeks ago, and I had to stop at a grocery store in Utah to pick up paper towels and toilet paper to bring back to Nevada. Cause I'm like, you people are idiots. Like, you know, so I'm like, hey, I'm stocking up on all the perishable foods, getting all this stuff. And I think it's really shift. People are paranoid. We have ring.com. I don't know if you guys have that out there.
No, I don't think so.
So it's a US thing where your doorbell has a camera on it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. And so, you know, people are sharing stuff, right? So, hey, you know, now that during the lockdown, you know, break-ins and vandalism has increased like 80-fold. So I get on my neighborhood app, people are like, this guy broke into my car. This guy was, you know, checking. People are just going up bluntly checking people's front doors to see if they're open. And I'm just like, well, one, park your car in the fucking garage, clean it out so they don't fuck with it. You know, you leave shit out there, people are going to mess with it, you know? So break-ins are increasing. I think people's, they're getting nervous about their own home security and people just being able to kick in the door or vandalize in the house. And they don't have security plans. They don't know what to do in the event of a home invasion. I won't call it a robbery, the home invasion. They just kick open your door and do a stronghold invasion in your house while you're there, you know? So I think that shift, people are starting to become more aware of security and safety. Long story short, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. The term I used when it first started happening was, our first world privilege is about to get a third world wake up call. and I think that's exactly what's happened. I mean, anyone who's worked or operated or lived in a third world country is going, oh, this is familiar.
You hit the nail on the head right there. That's it. A war-torn country is apocalyptic zone. You
know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, I saw some great memes from some of my South African friends about the current situation, and it's that, you know, the meme of the guy with the noose around his neck, and he's looking over going, first time? like yeah. I was like, yeah, that's true. You know, working with a bunch of South Africans, it's, yeah, they're looking at that going, it's like home. But,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the topic of the day. So the reason I reached out to you just recently was we've got a lot of civil unrest happening at the moment. And obviously at the time of recording, we've got protests happening in, across the US. A portion of those protests have turned violent. We've got people marching in the streets. We've got looting. We've got buildings being destroyed.
Churches.
Yeah. People's businesses that are unrelated to anything are being targeted just through destruction. But it's while that is certainly topical at the moment, what we're seeing in terms of the behavior isn't new. I mean, we see the same sort of things happening after natural disasters. Katrina obviously was one example of that. But we can even see it when sports teams win or lose, right?
Yeah,
we have short-term rioting and destruction. And I think what's most important for the individual is not really analyzing the politics of why this is happening or what should be happening, but what do we do about it if we're caught up in it, either through poor planning or pure luck? we're stuck. What do we do?
Well, if, you know, historically, well, one thing when we talk about writing is knowing your use of force in state laws. Every state in the United States is different. So thank goodness in Nevada, we have what's called the Castle Doctrine, which is pretty much stand your ground. You don't have to retreat. So if you're in your home or your car, and if someone's gonna inflict deadly force or severe bodily harm on you, a loved one, or someone in that area, you have a right to defend yourself. So that's run the motherfucker over in the car, potentially use your car as a weapon to get out of Dodge. If they invade your home, you don't have to flee. You can, you know, stand your ground. So understanding your limitations of use of force will kind of help you. And laws, like Nevada is great. I can walk around with a short-barreled AR-15 with a collapsible stock in my backpack with a med kit loaded up. And I'm doing that right now when I take my kids out, when we have to go places. You know, people are like, oh, that's obsessive. No, because if it fucking kicks off and I have my kids, you know, I'm gonna wreak havoc to be able to, you know, defend for myself and my kids and get them out of there if we have to. So that's the key thing, is understanding your state laws, understanding that use of force, laws of carry, what you can, what you can't. And the key thing is the biggest thing that I see people get stuck with on riots, let's say you go to work and half the city burns down and you're stuck at work. What do you have in your car to sustain you for 24, 36, 70, you know, 76 hours, right? What if communications go down? How are you going to communicate with your loved one to say, hey, I'm stuck at work, you're on your own? What if your kids are at daycare and you got to get from work to daycare all the way back home to shelter in place and to hold up? So it's like a sponge, man. The more water you put into it, the bigger it gets. But the biggest thing is have a plan, rehearse it, and live by it. So that's kind of the key thing, the key takeaway that hopefully people can get, because, you know, laws in Oklahoma or whatever you guys got in Australia, you guys are probably carrying axes. I don't know, bats with sticks or, you know, spikes.
You gotta have so many nails in a piece of wood, man. It's we're pretty restricted here, but
If you legally can carry a chainsaw and you're getting surrounded, you pump that chainsaw up and give it a couple of rounds, I guarantee you no one's gonna mess with you, right? So it's,
it's certainly interesting improvisation, but let's unpack some of what you said there in terms of planning and communications, because one thing I find with my friends that may be more prepared than the average person on an individual level, that's not always extended to their wives, partners, kids, etc. And like you said, if you get stuck somewhere where you're literally sheltering in place because it's not safe to leave the building, and you can't communicate, do they know what to do? And it's something that as my kids have gotten older, I've started trying to plan a little bit more and so that everybody knows their part. So because obviously if I'm stuck in place, I don't want my family to be sitting ducks. How do you recommend we have those conversations, maybe with people that don't have the same mindset? I mean, obviously I don't want to scare my kids, like young children that are very impressionable. But still obviously want them to know that when it's real, when it's serious, we need to take it seriously. How do you go about having those conversations?
Well, it's easy because my better half, she's always asking questions like, what if this happens? Like, what if I do this? And it's one of those things is if you and your spouse, you know, have separate workplaces, you know, have provisions in the car, right? So if things do kick off, you can get them out of the car into your place where you're sheltering down. God forbid they come and burn all the cars and burn everything down, right? So just having a basic checklist. And what I mean by a checklist of provisions, don't go buy some survival pack from Walmart or Amazon and never open it and just put it back in your car. And then you're trying to figure it out, you know, or stuff expires. So one, I would just say, hey, when I'm at work, if I'm there for 4 days, what do I really need, right? Food, water, shelter. Do I have a backup battery charger to keep my phone running? Another key thing too is have a book with phone numbers fucking written down. Because if your phone dies and you got to pick up a manual hardline phone, how are you going to call them? You don't know, right? So it's going back. Like when I look at protection back in the day when there was no smartphones and social media and all this other wild stuff, I'm like, how did we do it back then? You know, it was notes. Preparation, you know?
And I remember the first bodyguarding course I did, we had to literally print out maps from the street directories to do our route plan because, I mean, it was just prior to Google Maps and so on. So, it's amazing how things change and how lazy we get at knowing how to do stuff without technology. Yeah.
And right now, let's take the skill level of the husband and wife, right? If the wife doesn't really have a skill level, you don't want her loading her up like she looks like Rambo, right? You want to just go, hey, this is just what you need right now to stay in place and protect yourself. Now, for me, I'm loading up to not sustain. Like if I'm held up at work and they burn my truck down, I'm loading a bear and I'm getting on foot and I'm going to shoot and make my way to that location where she's at so then we can regroup or get home. So as an adult male, and what I mean by shoot, I'm not going to go there and just shoot, but have enough sustainable stuff to make it on foot where I need to be and hold up. So if you're like in New York, you're not going to have access to guns and weapons and stuff, but medical gear, food, improvise, you know, hey, you like baseball, carry a bat, put it in your backpack, right? Tennis racket, I don't know. But I would, what if the scenario, your scenario in your area to death and see, could you make it on foot? Where are points you could, you know, link up and go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. You made a valid point too about people buying the emergency packs and just throwing it in the back of the car and assuming they'll know what to do with it when the time comes. And one of the things I talk about all the time is that you can't think creatively in a crisis, right? You can only revert back to training and plans. If you're panicking, now, you will not be able to figure it. You will not be able to problem solve in a panic, right? So if you've never seen the gear before, there's no way you're going to figure out what to do with it in the heat of the moment. And I see this all the time with first aid kits. And I've been guilty of it before. Like you've got a first aid kit and like I'm digging through trying to find like the one bandage I need. And I'm like, I don't even know what this is for. Like, what do I do with that? And it's like, oh, I saw how to use it in a course 10 years ago and I've just had it in my kit ever since. It's probably expired 5 years ago. But it's so important to be familiar with what you're carrying. It's just having a bug out bag or having a kit in your car, it isn't the same as actually knowing what to do with it and when you would use it.
You know, and there's guys reach out to me and they're like, Aaron, you know, I'm trying to figure out what plate carrier and he's looking at this $400 or $500 plate carrier, not, you know, so in the end he's like spending $900. I'm like, hey bro, why don't you upgrade that little Yaris or Prius to a truck? That's not going to break down when you try to run over a curb or go off road. So it's like prioritize your spending, because if things are getting rough, like, you know, right now, I don't know if we were talking before, I bought a new push ram for the front of my truck.
Yeah.
you know, so I got a bigger and heavier one. So if I have to push through or rip through stuff, like, you know, I'm not going to damage my truck, and it's going to be able to, you know, maintain if I do have to ram stuff to get out of Dodge. So it's just prioritizing what you really need and to get you through the situation.
Yeah. And like you said, there's so much that is local knowledge as well. I mean, if you're in a tight urban environment, your needs are going to be different than if you're in a remote environment. Like you might need to carry extra fuel with you or get gas with you, because you might be in an area where once you're out of the city limits, you've got 200-300 miles before the next gas station. So,
well, people say, I'm going to bug out. Well, where the fuck are you going to go, man? Unless you have, like, I know dudes legit that, hey man, I got a campsite in the hills of, you know, Arizona, which is beautiful out there. I got grid coordinates just in case the map doesn't go down. I'm going to get up there, and they ain't shit for miles, you know, hundreds of miles. So I'm like, okay, sweet. Then, you know, when we talk about, you know, operating and working in those war-torn countries, you know, every time we left, you know, I was on the outskirts of Pakistan, and it's like, hey, you know, we're only going to leave for probably 4 hours, but if we get stuck or shit turns south, you know, what do we have to hold us up and to sustain us as a group? And the biggest thing is, let's say you have a father, a wife, and two kids. If you have a med kit, make sure that med kit is enough for all four people. If you have a trauma kit, people go, I got a tourniquet and quick clot. What happens if you get shot three times, right? So it's like two is one is none, but just having one of each is really not going to help. Make sure you have enough for everyone. That's always been a big thing. And then, you know, space blankets, and I'm a huge advocate of carrying water, all that stuff, but it's just simple means of just family travel that you need just in case you get stuck on the side of the road, because it happens.
Yeah. And I think there's a bigger topic, a bigger conversation to have here about first aid equipment. But one of the things that always struck me as odd, especially in 2020, with what we know about trauma first aid, is that most commercial trauma kits still don't have tourniquets. They still don't have chest seals. They may have a space blanket. But I mean, that's like the number, those are like the three things. Like, you want to keep people warm, you want to stop them bleeding, and you want to be able to, seal a sucking chest wound if you need to. Don't assume that the commercial first aid kit that had three bandages and a packet of Band-Aids is what's going to get you out of trouble, because it's probably not going to help beyond the worst case scenario might be a snake bite. You might be okay, but that's about it.
Well, I look at it as three levels. Is your first level line is what we call itchy scratchy, right? All your meds, flus, anti-inflammatories, allergy, eye washes, all that stuff, right? Then you move to the next one, which I call the 8-minute medicine. It's just basically a trauma or a med pack, if you have, you know, for bleeding control or severe injuries, that you can basically sustain that person for roughly about 8 to 10 minutes till technically first responders will arrive. Then you have the big kit, right? The big kit is basically, hey, this shit's going to have to sustain you for 2 or 3 hours till we get you to a FOB or we get you to center. So that's kind of the difference, especially in protection stateside versus doing protection overseas, is that the med bags are a bit different. Because if I'm doing EP in downtown LA or San Francisco or Vegas, I know I'm going to have immediate response, right? Overseas, uncertainty. But now, the shifts have changed where, you know, you have protection guys, you know, protecting newscasters during riots, or if they do do martial law, they're bringing in the National Guard. And so that might basically extend the timeframes of response for emergency response. So you might have to shift over to that heavier line med gear.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for people that let's say they don't have the means to bug out, they don't have anywhere to go to, they're going to shelter in place instead, about protecting their home, or let's say someone's looking at what's happening on the news at the moment going, look, I need to reinforce my home so that we can stay put and stay safe. What sort of advice do you give people if they're looking at that?
Fortify. So right now, the cheap way to do it, like, I don't, like, here in the States, I'm actually looking to get them done. They're roll it in shutters, where they're aluminum shutters that cover the window. If you don't have it right now, I literally went to Costco, and on the side of my house, I have 8 massive pieces of plywood. Just no different. What people do in Florida during the hurricanes is, if there are riots, you know, you can screw those in over the windows to limit access. Mainly what you can do, whatever you can do to fortify your house, it's not going to necessarily always keep someone out. It's going to buy you time, right? So if someone's trying to beat and pry the big piece of plywood that's blocking your living room window, it's going to give you time to think, decide, and act, right? That's a big thing. Also, too, if you're looking to shelter in place for a long period of times, please understand that depending on your water heater, a big one, you have 90 gallons of portable water. So there's people that are stuck going, oh, we're dying of thirst. No, you know, turn the little knob on your water heater, you know, and you got portable water, boil it, right? Yeah. You know, it could be things too, where you fill up one or two of your bathtubs with water, right? So you got water, you got sustainability. You know, right now, Amazon, before that stuff kicks off, you can order cameras that you can just basically screw in that are solar powered, and you can watch it with your phone. But talk with your neighbors, get to know your neighbors, and have a plan. Start that neighborhood chat. So if, you know, Don, who's on the very entrance, goes, hey dude, there's a mob coming down and they're throwing stuff, you can warn the rest of the neighborhood to either, one, hey, let's all, if you're living in a cul-de-sac, start piling cars in the front of the cul-de-sac to prevent cars from driving in. Yeah, people are still going to walk by, but you're denying a level of access. And then it's one of those things where you're either going to, you know, fight or hide and shelter in place because you can't really move. But I actually did a video that I'll be posting soon for a community out here in Vegas, a very high-end community, and they were very concerned. So there were stuff where tips where I go, hey, if you have side gates, lock them. They're like, okay, they're going to climb over the gate. Okay, yeah. You denied the first meeting. They're going, shit, I can't open it. Now I'm going to climb over it. Well, second indicator is buy some Christmas bells or jingle bells and hang them on the fucking fence. So if someone starts clinging, you have an audio indicator that someone's rustled around your fence. You know, if stuff goes really bad, I always suggest to save all your wine bottles and beer bottles, because then you can go Latin America on their ass and basically just silicone broken glass along your brick wall, your fence, to deny people from climbing. It's technically illegal in the States, but if this stuff goes bad, you can use that as an alternative means, right? Yeah. You know, you can fill your sprinklers with gasoline and then load your rifle up with a tracer round, so when they come in, you can turn on the sprinklers and fire. Just kidding, I'm joking. That's that's off the wall, but that was a meme that I seen. You know, but
that's yeah. Great idea. I mean, as long as you don't care about your neighbors or anyone else.
You know, simple things too, guys. Like, I think it costs like 100 here in the States. It costs about 100-120 bucks to put anti-kick bolts, which are longer bolts and screws in your door frame. So if someone tries to kick it in, it's going to take them a little bit longer, right? Or you can do the old school way and just get a 2x4 and drill it in. But just remember, if you fortify yourself in and that house catches on fire, make sure you have an exit plan and you can get out. You're not trapped in there.
Yeah, actually, in recent years, there's a bunch of great mechanical products out there now for designed for schools for active shooter situations that are equally applicable to home doors as well.
There's Adalock, Adlock. You can get it on Amazon. Christian West, CEO for a solution to that. And basically, it locks into the inside of your door frame for hotels or even house. And it's pretty tough to kick that in. Hmm. Another tidbit, too. Technology being used here that already been used in Las Vegas is where people are using iPads, so they can sit in the neighborhood and anyone who opens their garage or unlocks their door, it traps their sensors. So that's another big trend out here in Vegas, where people are basically using the iPads, unlocking the door of the car, then pop in the garage. So they're using technology to defeat alarm systems. So with that being said, every night before I go to bed, I basically, if you have a garage door opener in the U.S., it has a lock button. You push and hold that, your light will start flickering. As long as it's flickering, it means it basically shuts down. It locks the garage. So no one can use the garage door opener to open it up or close it. So keep your cars inside, you know, lock your garages. And the biggest thing too, is I tell, when we talk about having a plan, instilling that routine. So if you have a family, you kind of want to make an event. Hey, we're going to bed. All right. Who's setting the alarm? Who's checking all the windows that are locked? Make sure all the drapes and blinds are shut and closed, right? Before everyone goes to bed, and instilling those habits, they become habitual, or they become a habit, not habitual. They become a habit. And it's just basic security awareness where you're not leaving a window open so people can see inside. You're not leaving a window unlocked. You're making sure the alarm locks. And it's funny because 20% of people that have alarms do not set them when they go to sleep. I set mine every time I go to bed, right? And people that have them, oh, I just set when I'm away. No, if someone you know, tries to come in, that's an indicator. Two or three, whatever light I'm on. Have a plan with your family, meaning that if that alarm sounds in the middle of the night, your wife's priority is what? Probably to get to the kids. And then you're probably going to, I would suggest finding a room. I live in a two-story house, and one of the rooms, the guest bedrooms, has a walk-in closet. And I go grab both of the kids, get in that closet, and shut the door, because I know that where that area is over the garage. So if I get down and I get in a shootout and bullets start ripping through walls and stuff, it's not going to potentially go into a room that they are if it is going through the ceiling. So when that alarm goes off, she knows to grab the kids, go to a secure area. I'll pull security on the stairwell till she gets past me and gets the kids. Then I punch down and clear, and then I'll communicate. You know, she has, you know, her gun, she knows to hold up, and we'll communicate, hey, I'm coming back upstairs, or hey, I'm going outside, the house is clear. She'll move to the stairwell with the shotgun and pull security on the shotgun. The kids stay in there while I go outside, do a sweep. And then when I come back in, I go, hey, babe, I'm coming in. Okay, I'm coming upstairs. You know, put the shotgun down. Don't point at me. So it may seem basic, but having those, talking those situations through and just rehearsing them will become subconscious when that event happens.
Yeah. And what you said there about rehearsing is so important. Like, you can't just have this conversation once and expect someone who's never lived it to be able to remember and pull it off under, you know, a massive amount of stress. Yeah, it's something that we've moved house a lot over the last couple of years. And every time we go to a new house, I've got to look at it again and go, okay, what's the plan here? Like, how does this change things? And yeah, our current house is quite good because all the kids' rooms are at one end of the house and there's only one hallway to get there. So, you know, our plan is quite straightforward. I mean, I can hold that hallway until, you know, my wife has got all the kids and there's a back door behind us so we can get out. We can go to the neighbors. Like, there's, yeah, we've got options. But,
and when we talk about having a plan and rehearsing, the biggest thing is that, God forbid, anyone that is faced with a deadly force encounter, you're not going to rise to the occasion. You're going to fall back to your basic line of training, 100%. So if you don't have any, you're probably going to be a soup sandwich. And, you know, we talk about that means, the ability, the intent. You know, you're going to have to dig down deep and be a fucking savage, because if you don't have proper training, you're going to probably have to go Neanderthal or orangutan on them. But that's the thing, people are like, well, I have this and this. Well, have you trained? Have you rehearsed? Because it's not built in your subconscious, you know? So that's a big thing that I cannot harp on, you know, enough. And it's what I teach people, and I do an EP, and I still do to this day. When I go to bed, I have like a little reading chair right next. I put my pair of shorts, and I put my shirt in the same place every fucking night. So if that happens, I'm not digging around trying to find underwear and a shirt, right? You know, will I go to battle in, you know, in my boxers? Yeah, I will. But if I can put, you know, quickly throw that on, because if I do have to go outside to check something, I'm not scrounging around. So when I go to bed, I have that stuff sitting there every night. When I'm in my hotel on a detail, I have a chair in front of my bed with my bag, my gun, everything set up, my shoes, my clothes, so I can just pop out. I know exactly where everything is. I can put it on in pitch black and get things going. And one last rant, sorry. When I get people go, hey man, check out my home defense gun. And it could be a shotgun, it could be a pistol. And I'm like, that's great. But there's one problem. You don't have a light source. You don't have a flashlight. Yep. You cannot shoot what you can't identify. You hear something ruffling down and you go in there and you shoot an 8-year-old kid who broke in trying to steal an Xbox, right? So you couldn't clearly identify. So it's being able to identify and assess and address the situation before you dominate, eliminate, and control it, right? So for all you homeowners out there that are new gun owners, there's various ways, but make sure you put a light source on that gun and you learn to manipulate that light source accordingly so you don't blind yourself, backlight yourself, or, you know, fumbling the light and accidentally have a negligent discharge because it's on a handgun or whatever. So having a light source on any weapon platform is crucial.
Yeah, I've got a friend that as a teenager was nearly shot by her father while she was coming home late because she was trying to be considerate and go in the back door and not set off all the sensor alarms, the sensor lights. And yeah, dad heard her fumbling around and didn't have a light source on the gun and was very, very close. He finger was on the trigger. So nearly life-changing, obviously a traumatic event, but absolutely. What are the other essentials you think people overlook in terms of preparation?
It's my biggest thing was rotating my perishables. It sounds basic, but I got back there and I'm like, dude, I have canned food from like 2013 that, you know, we haven't rotated for it. And the biggest thing is the Mormon community. So being in Nevada, we're right next to Utah. The Mormon community are probably the best and biggest preppers in the world, you know, because they, at a minimum, per the religion, have to have 100 meals per family member in their home at any given time. So it was one of those things where me and my better half, she's going through, she's like, man, we're not rotating the canned food. Some of this stuff is out of date. We didn't use it. And it's that little stuff. And then going, well, I want to, you know, store meat. Or let's say you go out and kill a deer, right? You go out, hey, I'm going to go out and kill a deer, bring back. Where are you going to put it? You know, so I had to go out and buy a coffin freezer. You can buy them for $250 to be able to store meat and use it over time. Another big thing too is having a generator that can at least power your freezer and your refrigerator so your perishables don't go bad over time if there's a, you know, a blackout. What else? I mean, there's a long list. And like you said, I think a big thing too is gas. You know, don't let that gas tank get below half. Make sure it's fueled. Make sure you have stuff. And big thing too is just make sure you have a car. If you do have to move, it can get you and your family and the stuff that you need out and have a plan where you're going, right? If California, you know, completely collapses and turns into complete civil unrest and an apocalyptic rating, everyone's gonna go to two states, Nevada, or actually three, Nevada, Arizona, or Oregon. And those are all pretty much bottleneck highways, right? So now you're like, okay, sweetie, we're going to Aunt Jones in Las Vegas. And you get on that 200 mile two lane freeway in the middle of the desert and you get gridlock traffic for 3 days, you're stuck. You ain't going nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, so it's,
that's a really valid point, getting stuck in your car because there's nowhere to go. That's rough, man. Especially if you've got a car full of kids and like it's, yeah, you got to be prepared to leave that vehicle and, you know, proceed on foot potentially.
You know, and having a bag, let's say you have a disaster or a bag for your family, have multiple bags. So everything, the weight can be dispersed evenly throughout everyone, right? So if like, hey, everyone has their own backpacks, well, we have a case of water. We're going to split the case of water up along everyone's bags, right? Then when we use those, you know, when we're done drinking those bottles, collapse them and seal them so they're compressed so we can use those and fill them up later, right? That's getting like way off survival. But, you know, having a Thomas guide, like we talked about physical maps. I don't know if you guys have Thomas guides out there in Australia.
What are they? Might not be.
Thomas guide is basically you can buy a book of a region, a state, a county, And it's detailed, you know, because it's one of those things too where, you know, people are like, hey, we're going to take a shortcut or cell service dies and they're just driving and they'll end up in the back end of Area 51. They're going to be told to turn around, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Everywhere has these here. As they're called different things in different areas, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's just preparation. You know, we go down the list: food, water, shelter, and security, right? How much, you know, food can sustain for you and your family. Make sure, you know, the non-perishable stuff, make it last. Make sure you have, you know, enough water. Technically, having a gallon, you know, per family member per day is great. But if you're not mobile, you're probably not going to burn that up. Then we talk about shelter. You know, make sure you have a roof over your head. Everything's fortified. You got power, all the means. Then, you know, you work on that. You work on security.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for what you were saying before about being low tech. Is don't be a slave to needing a Wi-Fi connection for everything. Even just this year, it just randomly occurred to me, I don't know where anyone lives. Like I don't know anyone's address. Like I was thought about sending a card to someone. I was like, I need to ask you where you actually live so I can send that. So I've started reaching out to people again and saying, hey, what's your address? What's your phone number? Like I'm so used to just contacting people through Messenger or through WhatsApp or whatever that I don't know anyone's details anymore. Like I know their name and that's it. And
well, it's, yeah, I just filmed my little, in a podcast line, you can't see it, but I have my little, my field notes book that, you know, I put addresses, emergency phone numbers, contacts, all that stuff. So when I go training or do training, that's on me. So if something happens, they can't unlock my phone. They have everything they need to know about me or whoever in a little book. Going low tech, that stuff, like, oh, I got everything saved on my laptop. Well, if it does go apocalyptic, power dies, your laptop dies, you got to have stuff on physical note paper, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it, man. Like, it doesn't even have to be apocalyptic. You can just get locked out of iCloud. Right.
I was just going over all my life insurance forms and stuff, and I was talking to my better half, and I'm like, we can't keep this stuff online. We got to keep it in the safe or somewhere, because you won't have my login out, and God forbid something happens to either one of us, we have to have that information.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, you're then at the mercy of your cloud provider as to whether they're going to let you have access to that again. You need to at least have a backup somewhere. Yeah.
And this is another thing too. We're talking about security and shelter is, you know, being able to defend, you know, if needed. And the biggest thing that I'm seeing right now, is, especially during riots, is people are trying to protect their storefront. Like, these stores are their livelihoods. They've dumped their entire life savings, and it's sad to see that just random acts, they're going and burning stuff down, robbing, looting, and that can even go for your house over certain times. People could become desperate and say, hey, that looks like a nice house, nice neighborhood. I'm sure they have an ample supply of food, so let's go ransack it. And I think the biggest takeaway, and it's coming back now, is during the LA riots or the Rodney King riots, we always talked about the Koreans in Compton, down the rooftop Koreans. You've seen the memes now. People, what is that? I'm like, dude, I remember those dudes, man. They were on top of their liquor stores, and they were just burning dudes down and salvaging their businesses. And it's happening now. There's, you know, now, you know, tactical gear and all this stuff is a hobby. So these dudes are, you know, a lot of people, a lot of towns are like, what? I get to actually put on my plate carrier and get my gun and go do something. I'll get on it, boy. But they're going out and protecting storefronts and stuff like that. So with that being said, a sense of community, knowing your neighbors, having your network. So if you know, you may be in a part of town that may get hit harder than another, and guys are like, hey, it's bad. We're stuck. I'm with my family. I need help. Well, I'm going to rally the posse up. We're going to get in a motorcade and say, hey, how many's in the family? So we know when we come there, we call it client recovery, right? So it's like, how many's in the house? So we know where we can fit you. How much, you know, stuff are you bringing with you? And then we get a motorcade going, and we punch out to do a client recovery. We'll bomb into that bad area, pull in, set up security around the house, get the family up, get them loaded up, get them to a safer place. And with that being said, reason why I'm segueing this, because I've been working all morning on the new motorcade operations, AOP and QRF procedures. I'm putting a class on for ZERT to teach average civilians that if they do have to go into an area where they have to remove sensitive material, people, or help, or move across in riot or civil unrest areas, they can do it like a protection detail. They understand screening, blocking, and you can have a truck hanging back as a counter assault. So if they come, they can come in and react to the situation to get that convoy out. People are like, what are you talking about? I go, hey, look, if I have to move my family, my neighbors across the street, their kids, their wives are going in the protectee's vehicle, right? We're protecting that vehicle. We're putting them in. And then us, we're doing our stuff to get out of Dodge or get from A to B. And once again, it's one of those things where tricks and trades from working in war-torn countries, stuff for close protection, how this can become very relevant to the average Joe civilian to use it to go get a loved one or get out of Dodge.
Absolutely. I think there's also something to be said for actually understanding your own threat profile as well. Like who is your enemy? Like what are they motivated by? Because I mean, if you're holding up in your house to defend against a genocidal warlord that who's sending people in to murder you no matter what, that's completely different to people that are looting for supplies, right?
Yeah.
And look, I've got friends in South Africa that have been through some pretty horrific stuff. And one of the strategies that was common over there was literally just putting in secure shutters at either end of a hallway and putting almost strategically putting valuables outside of those shutters so that when the looters come in, they can find what they're looking for and leave you alone. So kind of like just, you know what, we'll sacrifice some stuff. And they had other supplies that were hidden within the secure area. So they weren't completely without anything, but they're literally just saying, okay, here's the expendable stuff that we can leave out so that when people come in, they can grab what they feel satisfied. They got what they came for and they leave without having to kill us or go looking for anything else. And, it's just an interesting psychology of dealing with that kind of situation as opposed to an actual,
And it's what's worth dying for, right? If I got to throw my, flat screen TV out front just to go, oh, sweet, boom, I'm out, then so be it. You know, that's that whole thing where, we talk about our TVAs, right? Your risk, your threat, your vulnerability, and your assessment. And you hit the nail on the head is identifying your threat. So when I'm watching riots, the rioting and looting on TV, it's human behavior, mannerisms, and like packs, right? So people run in packs. So I think this is a good way for situational awareness to, when you see stuff on TV, watch the different groups, who's being ultra violent, who's looting, who's standing there protesting, look at their mannerisms, their demeanors, are they looking at something? Is that something they're looking at, something they're wanting to destroy or loot, or is it a victim? Is it an accomplice that they're trying to get the attention to go do stuff for? And that's why I love, when we talk about situational awareness, micro mannerisms, and a lot of people say, well, if you're that close to someone, it's too late. No, like I you can get a true read of intentions of someone. It's kind of hard now with everyone wearing masks, but it's one of those things where we, watch this stuff and really think outside the box and look how people are pack animals and how they run and work together.
Absolutely. Actually, I just had a couple of weeks ago, I had Dr. Nate Meehan from Second Sight Training Systems on, and he's got a very, very interesting online training in threat assessment and identifying behavioral cues that don't rely on facial expressions at all. So if you have a vantage point, and you can just see how people cluster, how people move, direction of travel, things like that. It's very, very, very cool training to be able to identify what's out of the norm and investigate further. So, but again, there's so much to learn. But the great thing, if there's any great thing to come out of what we're currently going through, is that I think a lot of people have never thought about this and now having to think about it. And I think in general, we're going to end up a more capable society, I hope. So there'll be more people that end up capable as a result of this anyway.
I think, there's, and I call it like the five things I learned, during any situation, but I think you're absolutely right that it's making more people aware. So hopefully that it heightens their sense of vulnerability where they want to seek training or seek help. And when you talk about knowing your threat, the best way I can explain to someone when you're dealing with a threat is that person you're dealing with probably potentially came from a broken home, right? Wasn't fostered, was potentially raised on the streets, ganged, violent. It was just another daily occurrence. They've probably been in multiple fist fights, so they'll drop and fight at the drop of a hat, where most people in society have never been in a fight, never been punched in the face, right? They've been in and out of jail. So their escalation of violence is nothing new to them. So for them to inflict greater violence on you at the drop of a hat, they're not going to lose any sleep over it. Where if you know, people would probably pass out or freak out if they had to kill or cut the throat of a rabbit to feed their family. It probably distraught them. So that's knowing that, like, hey, when you're confronting hardened criminals, their thought process and their reality is completely different, and they're desensitized at a level that is completely scary. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, AS Solution, I've worked on a project in Honduras, San Pedro Sula, Honduras, which at the time was the murder capital of the world due to the segue of all the cartels, and now setting up programs in Mexico City. I'll tell you what, man, the cartels, if you go, hey, you want to go fight ISIS or the cartels? I'll be like, ISIS, I'll be raising my hand any day of the week, man, because one, they really don't have poker faces, right? They wear all their emotions on their sleeve, and that's just them culturally, right? And we joke around there calling them savages and stuff like that, but they're hardened warriors in Afghanistan that a hard life, you know, living out there in the mountains or whatever, creates a hard individual. Mexico City, they have more funding, more firepower, they're getting trained, and they are desensitized to violence to a whole new level where I hate watching some of the stuff that comes across, but I have to, in a sense, for my job to be desensitized by it. So if I do encounter it, I'm not freaking out, right? So it's just, it's a hard truth. And that's why there are A-type personalities, people that are the tip of the sword. And there are people that are very passive, and they're not A-types. They're not aggressive, you know, people.
Yeah, I mean, the cartel stuff is scary. I've got a listener who sends me some stuff from Mexico, and sometimes you got to steel yourself before you watch it. You're like, man, that's something that I didn't know human beings could imagine doing, let alone doing.
Yeah,
and there's actually, I was reading something a little while ago that suggested that I'm not sure. I think it might have been Al Qaeda actually learned torture techniques from the cartels, which was, I guess, reasonable. I mean, like,
yeah,
they've affected it.
You know, and it's one of those things where you see them, when you see, you know, like Al-Qaeda do executions, right? They're like, why is that guy just sitting there letting them cut his throat? Why is that guy just sitting there? Well, they basically do mock executions every day and nothing happens, right? So they don't know when it's going to happen, but what it's doing is, we talk about it, it's building that mentality. Oh, I'm going out. They're going to put a knife to my throat. It's going to get cut, or is it not, right? So they're just so, you know, beaten down mentally, it happens, you know. And when we talk about violence, the three regions, obviously Africa, South Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, right? You want to look at truly what evil is and what they're capable of, research that, and it'll open up your eyes and help you prepare. You know, everyone, you got to always level up. And we always joke around. It's like, hey, I'm sitting here watching The Simpsons, you know, drinking a beer, getting fat and happy and laughing. Well, dudes are out there training or not eating, they're PTing, and they're, you know, we always joke around with the old Vietnam term. You know, you're sitting here getting weak while Charlie's out in the jungle getting stronger.
Yeah.
And that's true.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. If people want to know more about Zert, or they want to look you up and get some training, get some preparation, and not be quite as useless if things hit the fan, where do they go to find out more?
Okay, well, guys, go to zertnation.com. We have a membership-based organization, so it's $50 a year, and there's levels of membership. We're getting ready to launch our ninth year membership, so when you join, you get a T-shirt, a patch, a call sign number, a certificate. We have over 140 private groups on Facebook. Right now, hopefully by the end of August, I'm launching our premier online training program that will be available for our premier members. So you can just sign up for the newsletter and get information that way. You can join and actually be a member. People in Australia, it's actually Q Squadron. New Zealand, it's Northeast Squadron. And then we have 140 squadrons worldwide. You have a call sign, so that's the number on your membership. So when you follow the ZERT page, you see a guy that's X1200, you know, X1209, that means he's part of X Squadron and he's the 1209th member. So right now we just pushed 25,000 members, which is really cool.
Wow.
If you go to ZERT702, I have over 900 videos on YouTube. Our Coffee and Hate series, we got stuff on rope works, swiftwater survival, rappelling, knot tying to CQB tactics, vehicle tactics to basic survival techniques. And it's basically just joining a network. We have a big group, groups everywhere, guys. So it's just kind of joining a network of like-minded individuals. And it's, you know, ZERT is what you make of it. You can really work hard to build your members in your area. So like right now, I'll be heading out to California in a few days, as long as it's not burning down. And I'm going to link up with a group of probably 60 members in Southern California. They do monthly range meet and greets. So I'm going to go out there and barbecue. We're going to train, do tactics, have fun. And all it costs on meet and greets is just the range fee. And there's guys doing that in North Carolina, Oklahoma. I know Australia, we've done medical classes and survival classes and all that stuff. So it's what you make of it.
Very cool. Very cool indeed. All right, Aaron, thank you very much for your time. It was fun to chat ZERT. Look, man, I hope things continue to grow for you guys. I know things are going ballistic at the moment. So, yeah, good for you. I'm glad a fellow prepper has found the fields with the right oats, mate. All right, Aaron's going to stick around and do the bonus questions for Patreon contributors, but for everyone else, thank you very much, Aaron Malden.
All right, thank you.
Thank you once again to Mr. Aaron Malden for an enlightening and interesting conversation about all things disaster preparation, civil unrest, etc. Make sure you check out ZERTNation.com for more from Aaron, and always the bonus content is over at www.patreon.com/managingviolence. Until next time, I'll talk to you again soon.